New England summers don't exactly ease you in. 1 minute, the windows are open. The next, your apartment feels unbearable. Well, meet Windmill Air. Windmill window ACs are sleek, they're quiet, and cool your space fast without the bulky eyesore. Rated the number one easiest AC to install, Windmill lets you adjust temperatures right from your phone and, unlike traditional units, cools your room more evenly like central air. Shop Windmill online at windmillair.com or pick up an AC at your nearest Target or Home Depot. Windmill, modern air care your room deserves.
Off the ball, GAA.
The low management thing definitely wasn't the same then. But when you're young, you can kind of just, ignorance can get you through at times. But I actually think I got better as well when I got out of college in, because I didn't have that extra stimulus of playing college.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Here it comes, opportunity, O'Reilly! The League of Ireland is back this Friday night on Off the Ball, whatever the weather.
Can you believe it?
A team of distinction and real big spenders, Derry City host Bohemians after their 4-goal haul last weekend.
An instant response from Derry City.
Can City get off to a good start for a change, or will Bowes get that loving Whelan?
Back pass here, Colin Whelan has scored for Bohemians.
There's sure to be fireworks on Foyle side. Join us on Off the Ball this Friday from 7 p.m. on News Talk or the Goal Out app for live and exclusive commentary of Derry City versus Bohemians.
A beautiful finish.
League of Ireland on Off the Ball.
You're one of the great disbelievers in momentum.
Well,
is far momentum?
I think that
one of the same.
I think that it's an overrated concept. I wouldn't dismiss that. Yeah, one team gets the upper hand over another. But I do think that confidence is actually what we're talking about. And it becomes this kind of very lazy, oh, they've got all the momentum now. And then the ball is out of play for 5 minutes and like they still have momentum, but actually the momentum's been broken.
It's like in the aftermath.
I think it's more like of a confidence thing on the part of the team that is not experiencing this momentum, as opposed to an overconfidence or an extra bit of confidence in the team that is experiencing the momentum.
I hadn't thought about the opposition. It was more that essentially the theory comes from American football, where every single play is a brand new play.
Yeah.
The notion that you can carry on from one play to the previous play because the previous play was good is just it's kind of fallacious. It's made up.
Mm.
Like the whole game starts again when the ball goes dead, and essentially that should be the opportunity in all sports when the game goes dead. It's like you know. But anyway. Not to go down that rabbit hole. Yeah. And like, is that just because somebody has just got confidence for that 1 second, or the ball is broken a bit flukily, or you've made your own luck? Anyway, you want
James Flanagan will have answered them all.
You want to talk about momentum, do you?
No, well, it's just what you mentioned, form. It is. It's really interesting. It's really, really interesting because it is. He's not here this morning, so we can relitigate it. But it's funny how in hindsight the Cork goal at the other side of half time was seen almost. I heard it referred to this in the last few weeks somewhere. I forget where I was listening and I do apologise. I heard it referred to as like, oh, it's the worst thing that could have happened.
To Cork.
6 points. When it was like in the moment, it was like, that is not how that felt at all.
No.
It was like, this
I
is
felt like,
amazing.
Right, okay, yeah. We're going to run away with it here.
And it's funny, I suppose it's all dictated by the result. What happens in the end. So it doesn't, I don't know how, it's funny because we only ever assess these things in hindsight.
Well, definitely, you felt like at halftime Tipperary had played quite well and were creating opportunities but hadn't taken them. But that didn't in any way foreshadow what was going to come in the second half. But it's fairly interesting to hear somebody who's like, been part of one of the best teams that we've ever seen talk about form, because he's had it and lost it and had it and lost it.
Yeah.
And has spoken to us about that. So I'm not...
Yeah.
And then how do you... Is there anything somebody can say to you to get it back? Or do you just have to go and spend 7 hours at the ball wall and go, oh, I have it now again.
And so is that slightly more macro, I suppose? Isn't it a slightly more over time? Because I distinctly recall that, and I think I mentioned this last week, when we were talking to your man, John Perry, the guy in UL, who does the coaching for all the thing, for all the performance coaches and stuff. And he rubbishes the idea of a half-time team talk. He thinks this is, and that's a slightly more sort of micro element of it within a game. He thinks it's nonsense. He's like, there's nothing that can be said in that time that can change things to that degree, to the degree that people go in, it's like, oh, it's like a different team. It's like you're just falling back on the work you've done. That's his theory.
But I'd love to get him back on to ask, because specifically I think that there's two elements to it. One is like the technical side and the tactical side, and then the other is the motivational thing. Right?
Yeah.
Because like, you know, famously, Johnny Sexton stands up at halftime, Leinster getting hammered by Northampton, they go out in the second half. But the front row were like, no, that's not what happened at all. We were, he was over there talking about Liverpool, yeah. And we were like, oh, the scrum is getting destroyed here, what's happening? And somebody did a bit of video work, and they're like, well, obviously Sexton went out and scored 22 points himself, so it was you know, but yeah. So success has many fathers, I suppose, is the one side of that. And then there is a company who are set up to work on halftime team talks. People who've been on LinkedIn for ages who are like, oh, we do this thing if you're any interested in talking to us, so maybe we should get them on. I just was interested as well in the, like, Davey going up to Antrim, telling them all, I'm going to teach you how to walk again.
Yeah.
It's very clough, isn't it?
Yeah. And then the other thing, matchups, how do matchups work? And how you are hurling analysts, the best ones, you know, James O'Connor would always come on and go, this is going to be who gets this right and who gets this wrong? And how does that matter? And how do you fix it? And what can you do? And how much of it is like preordained? So that's a bit of the hurling chat. And if anybody wants anything else, you can get us on 0879 180 180.
But do you remember, did you ever read Jackie Tyrrell's book?
Yes.
And
a lot of flaking in it.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. You did the interview with him, didn't you?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. But it was him, wasn't it, who had the great thing about like the picture of Lara Corbett on his home screen on his phone. So it's like, you're talking about matchups. You're like, literally every time he opens the phone, it's like, Lara.
Yeah, Lara, there he is again. Constantly thinking about
so
it.
That must have been before maybe 11 final, because I think it was after 10. I don't think it was for 10, but when he obviously runs riot. So it's funny. It obviously gets, but hurling's kind of unique, not unique, I suppose football's quite the same, but like, it is funny because he seemed to be doing that from a while out. You have that kind of ability to foresee, like, you know, like you'll, it's kind of that strange thing in hurling where you know you're going to face probably all
especially
the best
that period.
Yeah. So it's like, we can plan this from like May. I'll be thinking of this guy for like 4 months from now.
There was a match report done around the time, I think by Dennis Walsh, where he referred to Jackie being run around like he was a bollard. Jackie put that in his. Stored that one away for months and months and months and months.
Jesus.
And God. Brought it up years later.
Yeah. Well, that would stick with you.
Yeah.
it would, yeah, sure.
Is it worse being run around like a bollard or run through like a gate?
I'd say at least the gate, you can close it at some point in the future.
Yeah, the bollard ain't moving anytime soon. Yeah. Unless it gets lifted over. You have to lift it over. Like, yeah, it wouldn't be good either.
So that's what we're going to talk with James Flanagan about around about 9:15. Before that, we've got Bodo Glimt and Arsenal with Jonathan Wilson. What the hell is going on?
It's incredible. It's
worrying.
It's
is it worrying or very enjoyable?
It's like, for me, incredibly enjoyable. Yeah, I'm getting a good kick over.
You don't like Arsenal at all, do you?
I'm not
meaning in a fan sense. I mean, they just
rub me up the wrong way a little bit, I think.
Aesthetically.
Yeah, I just don't think they're not the best watch. I mean, yeah, I'm not saying I'm no the ordinary there, but.
Isn't it weird that people are actually hoping Manchester City win the league this year? Isn't it a weird sequence of events that has led to this point where 115 charges, the most money spent ever in the history of football on anything, on any project, on behalf of city-state. And we're like, yeah, you go and you kill those Arsenal fans.
It's a weird one to sort of wrap your head around and explain, because it doesn't make any sense, like, in that you want this, not you want this City team to win, but you would rather them win it over the likes of an Arsenal. I mean, I'm neutral in a sense in that, like, I don't have skin in the game in terms of your Premier League
football,
teams or whatever.
Football,
like,
in the game.
Football in the game. Yeah, no, I know, but like, I don't have like a bias towards any of the teams that are up there. But I don't know why that is. Like, I think, is it a thing about Man City that it just doesn't feel real? Doesn't feel legitimate. It doesn't feel like it, like, even though they win, it's like,
it doesn't matter.
Like, and although it does matter and they are racking up a serious amount of titles, it's like, but it just feels like if Arsenal win it, that matters, like, because it's Arsenal have won a league and whatever, and if you're not a fan of Arsenal, then you don't want that to happen. Whereas if City do, it's like, okay, well, look, you'd rather City over anyone else because it's not proper.
Doesn't count, really.
Yeah, and I don't know what them terms mean, like legitimate, proper, real. I don't know, but it just doesn't feel the same. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, and I feel like maybe, I don't know, when like someone who dopes at a Olympics or something and wins a medal and you go back 10 years later and it gets taken off them, they still feel like we looking at it still feel like, yeah, well, they still won the medal. They still came first. So if it does get a retrospective thing with City that these get stripped off them, it's not going to be like, okay, well, Man United won the league that year, or Arsenal won the league that year, but it's still just, yeah, I don't know why it is, because it doesn't make sense. I do agree. It doesn't make sense that you're encouraging this Man City sort of machine, illegitimate machine to...
Do you know what I've likened that to as well, and I feel exactly the same. I always feel it's like it just cancels out. It's like, all right, okay, that's fine. Everyone understands what happened here. But been obviously watching a lot of figure skating.
Mm.
And it's astonishing how many Russian skaters who can't skate under the Russian flag, obviously. And that would have been, were they banned for Beijing or was it before? I suppose it's 4 years since the anniversary. So it must have been pretty much toe and toe. There's just so many Russian skaters who now skate for Georgia skate for Hungary or skate, like, it's just, they're spread all over the place. But it's so funny with the talking about it, and the commentators, to be fair, they don't bother themselves too much with getting into the geopolitical stuff,
the weeds of it, yeah.
These things, but it is like, oh, it's a great day for Georgian figure skating. It's like, kinda, yeah. I guess. But even the team that finished second in the pairs one for that amazing Japanese performance, and I was looking at it, and it was a German team who finished second, and the man, he's Russian. Now I don't know what his origin story was, but it's just funny how the Russian skaters just spread right across this thing. The nation things doesn't really make a blind bit of difference.
Yeah.
And it kind of, to your point, it doesn't show any sort of illegitimacy. Everyone's doing everything above board, but it does kind of allow you to kind of go, it's like, this isn't all that it seems. Like, this is there's a lot of play here that really isn't being addressed at all. And I think with City thing, it feels similar. Yeah.
There probably is. I just see a comment here. City winning means no one is going to be goading you because you have no fans. Like, it's not a personal goading of me, but it's just like they win and you don't hear too much about it. It's like, okay, that happened and we move on. You know, whereas...
I do have family who are season ticket holders.
Yeah. Oh, well, okay.
They live in Manchester.
To be fair, actually, I do have a couple of mates who are City fans, but they're not that loud, so I don't really...
Knowing actual people from Manchester who are City fans, that's unusual, I would say.
It's just family, just the way it is. Like, that's my mother, but I'm both mother and father's family live over there. But my mother's family, it's her cousin. They've been season ticket holders. I remember going over there in the early noughties, long before any of this. It was. I remember going over there at one stage, and he was driving us around, and it was just before they were about to move into the stadium they were in. So it had been built or whatever, and they were kind of just, remember, showing us the stadium, like, where they were going into, and now they're there. But, it was a far way from what it's become now. But there, his son, I don't know what cousin that makes of mine, he's going, like, now to every home and away game with his son.
Yeah.
So my mum's cousin's grandson, like, every home and away game.
Yeah.
They're obsessed.
Okay, so you do actually have some personal experience of what it means to the people of Manchester, which is, still, you don't actually, as a Man United fan, you don't care.
No, I'd be happy enough for them. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, you're kind of like, that's always different when you know people and you're like, I'd say they've had some amazing nights.
You'd be happy for them in a patronising kind of way?
No, Jesus, they're great. Oh, like,
good
no.
for you.
Good for you.
Oh, well,
yeah, no,
there, you because, like, it's Premier League.
I wouldn't equate what following Man United means to me to what following Man City means to them. Like, their thing is...
It's real.
It's, local. It's everything. It's part of the community. It's where you
grew up. Limerick is the first in the similar.
Even that's one degree removed. Like, but
that
it
makes
is...
it all the more powerful, I think.
Yeah, anyway. Perhaps, but... I do, yeah. I have less of an issue with City for that regard, or their fans or whatever. Like, I don't have that same sort of. There's an antipathy for the club and what it represents now because of what it is. But, like, for the actual people following it, there's a certain powerlessness.
Yeah.
Like, what are you going to do? Like, so I don't think there is any less authentic from their behalf. But ultimately, they still do kind of fulfill a role. It's kind of a convenient bogeyman who, like, you don't have to confront it. That's what it's so bad when Liverpool win it.
That's what it's convenient. Just like,
oh, Christ.
Yeah. You would be worried. I'd be concerned now after watching that game last night with Arsenal Wolves. There was a lot of signs there of the trademarks that kind of get thrown at Arsenal about, you know, not being able to get over the line and not having the steel when it comes down to it and being able to push on when they need to and being the hunted as opposed to the hunter and all that sort of stuff. There was a lot of signs there of that ringing true. Like going 1-0 up early away from home against a team.
5 minutes, wasn't it?
Yeah, against a team who are already relegated as good as, if they're obviously not mathematically.
They do seem to have some matchup issues with Wolves in that it requires fluky on goal for them to lose the game at the Emirates.
But then, then to think, okay, right, they'll kick on here, not to kick on. And then when Wolves are on top, to actually go 2-0 up with a half an hour to go, whatever it was, 25 minutes to go, and then go straight to, like, immediately after kickoff, they can see the goal like that. A good goal, nonetheless, but still, defending is terrible when, is it, Matthias Mané picks up the ball and he flicks it over his shoulder. It's a good touch, but it takes three Arsenal defensive players out of the game. And it's a good finish, but to then go concede in the manner that they did. So much time to line it up. Raya is probably a bit too far off his line. Just looking at it on the eye, not to judge a goalkeeper. But
was it you or Phil likened him to Barthez?
I think Phil said that in the office this morning.
I was like, oh, that's a great.
He's just quite far off his line. It just looked a bit strange because when the ball actually hits the net, it's not really anywhere near the top corner. But then the goal they could
see. A bit harsh, isn't it?
It probably is a bit harsh.
No, I'm not saying save that.
I think, like, for a goalkeeper of his perceived standard, he wouldn't be over the moon with it, you know?
It was very telegraphed what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, again, it's not, all Premier League players can do that.
Yeah, exactly.
They can do that to you.
Yeah. But the goal they could see at the end of the game. Oh, it's like, that is tragic. It's tragic.
That's going to haunt you.
Even the scenes after, the actual frustration, the tetchiness about them on the pitch, and then what happened after is probably a bigger tell than anything that actually did happen during the game.
It was William Gallas smacking the ground. You're like, oh, don't be doing that, lads.
Yeah.
Don't be getting in a fight with Wolves.
Mm.
Don't be thinking about them. You've just made a mistake. It's fine. It's over. But now you're like,
point game, keep going.
Now everybody's looking at you going, oh, you've cracked. You've cracked again.
Yeah.
Look at you.
And
Arsenal.
Yeah. That's it, though. It's like, that's the perception of them. And they had gone some way this year. Some way. I think there was still a lot of people who had hesitancy there as to whether this would inevitably happen. But they'd gone some way to kind of rubbishing that a wee bit. And they've sort of opened up that can of worms again over the last sort of 10 days, notwithstanding their comfortable win on Sunday, which we won't get into against Wigan.
So what happens now? What happens? What do we expect from Arsenal now? Like, a nice handy fixture list of local London games. They get to sleep in their own beds.
Mm.
Sunday becomes hotels. An awful lot harder.
It's a hotel thing when they were playing Brentford. To travel. They don't get to stay in the same bed yet.
They're
Brentford's only up the road.
They're going to Spurs.
Then they have Chelsea.
Spurs away under their new manager.
Yeah.
Now,
or Tudor.
Spurs are terrible, though.
Abysmal.
Yeah.
They are, but like, if there's any hope left for the club, that's the day where you got to imagine the place becomes a little bit more imposing and a little bit more. They will be desperate to get something out of that, anything, just to be another little bump in the road for them.
If they could have their worst season in, like, you know, modern history and
still manage
screw Arsenal a bit, like, that'd be great. Yeah. It's great to actually have a bit of a bit of action up the top of the league there, you know. It's brilliant.
It'll be fascinating because I have no concept of what to expect from an Igor Tudor team.
No,
I'm not sure what he's bringing to the table, but
he's
been involved in a lot of big games.
That's it, yeah, and he's been at a lot of big clubs.
Sacked by a lot of big clubs.
So this is the thing, he's been portrayed as like a firefighter who comes in and does a job and goes, but I don't know. I don't know about that. I don't know if it's a case of his stints have just been short as opposed to, you know.
He's not leaving of his own volition, like.
Yeah, I don't know. I could be wrong there. But he comes across as quite an imposing figure from what I've seen of him. So he might...
Maybe he's the fire starter.
The fire starter.
he has, to be fair. He doesn't last too long anywhere, and I don't think he'll last too long at Spurs.
And that's probably that's obviously not the intention either. So
yeah, exactly.
That's fine.
He was the Juventus manager the previous season.
Yeah, well, it
was 2025. Marseille, he did okay with Marseille for a while, I think.
It went under the radar how badly Juventus were beaten by Galatasaray the night, did it?
Yeah, they got badly.
I happened to be watching it.
Okay, that was early, wasn't it?
Because it was the early kickoff. Yeah, and it was on Virgin. Well, it was crazy because they were two and up at half time.
Could have been. Yeah.
I think so. I'm almost certain they were leading at half time, and then come out and they get opened up like again and again, and then they go down 10 men, so that's even worse. But it's not like there was none of that kind of, well, we'll stem the flow here, lads, and just like buckle down for the next while. It's just
2-1 up at half time. Yeah,
it kept getting worse and worse for them.
They conceded 5 and Victor Osimhen didn't score any of them.
Yeah, so right back
names there in that. Galatasaray scoring, Davinson Sanchez, Gabriel Sara played for Norwich, Sacha Boey, Bayern.
They were Italian club bench. football.
Yeah.
But somebody sent all the Serie A teams out of shockers in the Champions League.
Inter.
So Inter Bodø/Glimt. What? This is mad.
It's amazing.
Serious outfit.
Bodø/Glimt beating City was like, oh, shock. So he's going to go. It's the end. The sky is falling. Even Spurs did it. Okay.
Yeah.
It's like, hang on a second. They in that game, they were brilliant.
They were brilliant. And they were brilliant last night.
And it's like, it's not a fluke. It's like, here's how we do things. We're muscular, smart.
Really quick on the counter as well. And like some players with just great touches.
Yeah.
But I don't understand, what I don't get is how no one's kind of clocked it yet. Not clocked it in terms of like on Bodø/Glimt aren't a better team than Inter Milan over the course of a season, right? In general terms, I'd suggest. But I don't understand at the same time how Inter Milan go into that game and seem to be caught unawares of what's going on.
Mm.
Like, it doesn't make any sense. They're top of the league. They're top of the league. South of Serie A.
Just a bit too cold for them, was it?
Like, I was looking it up. Because I was just interested when Martinez was doing the pre-match thing with the captain. And I was like, he's just over 8,000 miles from where he was born. Like, that's a long old journey. It's just like football kind of does these things. But I it was astonishing.
I wouldn't say many people from his hometown have been in Bodø. You know? Maybe they have.
It was an astonishing...
They were dazzled by the Northern Lights. Is that what happens? Everybody gets somehow mesmerised by something happening in the local area. Is there a sirens calling them
something
to the fjords?
Deeper.
Trying to think of something.
Fjords. Yeah, I know. But yeah. It's an astonishing story.
The V-shaped valleys, is that what they have in the glaciers?
Yeah, the glaciers, yeah.
What are they called? Are they fjords?
They're fjords. Fjords,
yeah.
They're like
fjords.
They're rivers in between the big things. Like, yeah.
What's going on?
It's mad, and it's mad because they have it's not like there's any, well, not that I know, there's no, it's not one of those freakish things where someone's invested a fortune and it's kind of a,
no, it's not
disproportionate.
The,
it seems quite
Maltese
organic
team or the,
oh, the Cypriot team that Colin likes,
Paphos.
Yeah. There's nothing like that. It's just a really, like, there was 8 Norwegians last night, 2 Danes and a Russian.
Steve Magnus has been tweeting about this week, so I'm taking it straight from there. Norway, obviously top of the medals table at the moment.
Certainly were, yeah, last day or two, yeah.
And they have Carson Warholm in the 400 metres, and they had the Ingebrigtsen, so obviously I think we're maybe an exception to the rule in terms of how...
Was young Nordas as well.
How hard they were trained. Victor Hovland, I think he's Norwegian as well, is he? Obviously, Erling Haaland.
He's definitely is Danish.
There's one of them anyway. One of them is Norwegian.
Yeah.
Swedish, Scandinavian guys, anyway.
Norway's director of elite sport told USA Today writer Dan Walken, "We think the biggest motivation for the kids to do sports is that they do it with their friends and they have fun while they're doing it, and we want to keep that feeling throughout their whole career. So no scores kept until they turn 13. And no results published in the papers of the underage stuff, and no individual sport specialisation. Seems to be working."
Yeah.
Seems to be working.
It's a very, it does seem like a too considerable golden age to be just kind of good fortune. It's a crazy spread.
That seems like the type of thing that would get a good bit of pushback over here, just as a
feeling. I deserve the right to be Jose Mourinho on the sideline from my under-10s.
Just as a feeling I have, yeah, and I'd agree that's ridiculous. Like, but I wonder over there, is it a unanimous, like, we're all going to do this?
I think it probably takes leadership at institutional level in all the big sports institutions who are like, oh, we're going to change the way things are happening here. There's definitely, I do often wonder if, like, you stop breaking the kids down to individual years and you just put stuff on every night of the week for kids aged between 8 and 11 as opposed to the under 8s, the under 9s, under 10s, under 11s.
Well, they've got something different, yeah.
Got everybody to play all the sports. Would they last longer? Is it some kids in class are different ages, so their friends are in different age groups and they train in different nights and they drop out because they've no pals.
Mm.
It's like, well, maybe if they all trained on the same night, they could go to that night.
And there's also gain there to be had too, in that, like, you know, a kid who's very small for his age at 8 and a kid who's bigger for his age at 8, he'll get more out playing with lads who are 10 or 11.
Yeah.
The other lad might get more out playing with lads who are 7, you know?
Maybe we'll get somebody off from Norway to explain exactly how it worked, because I suspect it.
There's definitely something.
It's a massive cultural change that we'd be looking for.
They don't have the GAA though, of course.
No, they don't have the GAA or, as you were saying, rugby.
Yeah, I was saying that.
to ruin things.
Yeah.
They've got winter sports.
I'm sure they've
hockey and curling and.
I'd love to know the actual breakdown of.
Sorry, 5.5 million population.
Yeah.
So, like for like. Obviously, they're one of the richest countries in the world.
Mm.
Their sovereign wealth fund is richer than Saudi Arabia's, I think. So, yeah, maybe they have slightly better facilities and more coaches full time working. I don't know. Actually, that'd be worth.
Yeah.
I'd love to know as well the demographics of. Obviously, it's such a long country.
So it should be harder for them, is what you're saying.
Well, no, I wonder, like, do the majority, I wonder, are there a disproportionate number of winter Olympians or winter athletes from the northern part
of the country? From a certain part of it, like, that's
like, I don't know what and that's genuine, I don't know. Like, I don't know if you're from the southern part of it, maybe, do you have the same access? Is it different depending on where you are? Is it kind of.
Yeah.
I
presume if you live beside the mountain, you're better at the mountain stuff.
Yeah, possibly. But it's, it's astonishing, but who knows?
The Ireland team,
possible
Ireland 15 seems to have been well flagged, the changes that are coming. So at halfback, it is Gibson Park and Jack Crowley. It is James Lowe and Robert Balakoon on the wings. It's McCluskey. It looks like Ringrose has allayed any injury fears, which is kind of important given. It would have meant blowing everything else up if he hadn't been playing. And Jamie Osborne's going to play at full back. The front row, it looks like it's Jeremy Lukeman. I will get that fixed. Jeremy Lukeman.
Let you finish that.
Tyke Furlong. So Furlong comes in to start and Sheehan keeps his place. Joe McCarthy keeps his place in all the teams today alongside James Ryan. So they're going for that. We need to add the agricultural heft. Big beef. Big beefy. Big D4 beef. Tyke Byrne is playing 6. Josh van der Fleer is back at 7. Caelan Doris reverts to 8. Jack Conan reverts to the bench. Kelleher, Tom O'Toole, Finlay Beelum comes in on the bench. So it's very experienced in that perspective. Finlay Beelum, our best scrummager, said somebody recently. I don't know, was it Rob Herring or somebody? Anyway, somebody was saying that he's our best technical scrummager. I was kind of surprised to hear that, but that's what the view was. And then it's Conan, and then Adogbo or Izuchukwu or Timoney. 2 from those 3. Craig Casey's back on the bench. And Kieran Frawley comes in.
Frawley's back.
I did say Frawley. But anyway.
It's just even the promise of proximity.
Yeah.
Connacht and Lancaster.
Just on the loop back thing. Very quickly, you didn't happen to catch the Kildare Derry game at the weekend, did you?
Go on.
Young Sarsfield's man scored 10 points for Kildare. Ben Loakman, Loakman.
There you go. Local variations.
Yeah, there you go.
Are you all going to start calling him by the wrong name?
That was where I was going with this. Yeah. Loakman. How do you say his name? Let us know.
What do you make of that team? I think, well, just to paraphrase Will Greenwood yesterday, where's the pace?
Mm.
Really?
No.
Josh coming straight back in, right? Was he injured? Was there something going on? Were they resting him? Has something happened that they're like, actually, you're back to your best now? Maybe they feel like him starting and Conan and Timoney coming off the bench. Still in the game in 50 minutes is exactly what they need. I don't know. It doesn't seem hugely consistent with the teams that they've picked up to this point, but it's more experienced. And you can see how they're trying to calm the nerves of everybody involved. You know, he got battered by France, absolutely savaged. we were in significant difficulties against Italy. And yet at the end, we had the opportunity to get a bonus point win. And there's a lot of noise, a lot of outside noise around the team. So you bring in Furlong, you put Beelam on the bench, you reckon your scrum is going to get, it'll be 60-40 to them as opposed to 90-10. Jacoby, England's scrum has become a massive weapon. And you've got a lot of know-how and nous and experience, and nobody really is being exposed here to something that they haven't been involved in before. Maybe Crowley hasn't started a game at Twickenham, has he? That year, did he start? He must have started that game.
Must have been, you know, two years ago, wasn't it? That was a bad day for him, wasn't it? Am I misremembering that? I feel like it was. I don't know when it fell. I could be wrong on that. I just feel like that's been mentioned the last week or so. That was a chastening enough day for him. I think Ireland. Anyway, I won't keep speculating.
So at least it's not new experience for him. Maybe not a happy one. Look, I don't know. I don't think it's going to have any impact on the spread. I think England by 11 is still there. Like, yeah, I think that makes sense.
Assuming that is the team, it's a broad question, but what would you suggest it signified of Andy Farrell's thinking heading into this game?
What's the approach?
What do you mean?
Like, obviously no one ever wants to get beaten, right? But is that a team
to keep the score down?
I'm asking. No, not even keep the score down. I would say there's every chance Ireland go there and win. I don't think you could write that team off in terms of that general Ireland team off. But
Ireland are 4-1 to win now, which is massive odds.
Yeah, it's out there. But do you think, like, I suppose in an ideal world, right, say where both performances so far had been better and closer and thing, it wasn't that kind of feeling of slight panic, maybe not from within, but certainly from without looking in. Do you think that's a team as a response to the last two games and that pervading sense of we really can't afford to be beaten badly here? Or is it kind of, no, this is a progressive kind of choice that... This has kind of more so, I'm saying, like, is it more backward looking or is this team for more forward looking in terms of are you reacting to what's happening or is this a proactive pick that it's like, this is the team we would have gone with regardless of what happened before? This is what we want to try. There's something here that we see.
I'd say they'd love if somebody had burst in and demanded a start and been like absolutely sensational. I think there's a possibility that Balakoon might have been that player if he'd been fit for the first game. Because he was good, right? So him and Osborne and Lowe could end up being a really good back three who are very capable of dealing with the high balls that England send our way. And they might win a couple of balls going the other direction. And that transforms how we play. I think there's a possibility that Tadhg Byrne finds form at six. I think that second row, there's a lot of pressure on them because obviously James Ryan had the brain fart in November and the suspension afterwards, but has been good when he's been playing. Big Joe hasn't been good. He was grand last week against Italy, actually. You know, started okay, but the impact kind of wore off as the game went on. So I think Tadhg Furlong being fit, like, is transformative for the scrum. I know everybody's going to, well, he got his wings last week, but let's wait and see exactly if that something like that happens again. So I'd say this is a team to win this week.
Yeah.
It's not a team building for the World Cup.
Yeah, okay.
There's no aspect of it that you could say is like, oh, this is what it's going to be. This will be our strongest thing here in the World Cup. Maybe 9 and 10. Maybe they think that Gibson Park with Crowley in this big game, it's an opportunity for us to have Crowley do a really defensive... I'm going to show you I can kick the leather off the ball and put it behind their back three and then our defensive line-out. We've picked a really strong defensive line-out.
Yeah, a lot of talk before, like, the Six Nations was, would we kind of take a not-so-successful Six Nations if it meant that we blooded a few guys for the World Cup? I don't know if we exactly done that. Is that where there's a bit of angst in that? It doesn't seem like we're doing one or the other.
So not to sit in the fence in that, but
yeah,
you can't know that until the end of the tournament,
the
right?
Up, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Well, even just until the end of this tournament. But so Dogbo has now been in the squad, and this is the first time he's been fit in 2 years, and he understands exactly what a match week is like and what the responsibility of being in the squad is like. Balakun is back fit and playing, and Nick Timoney has emerged as somebody who actually can totally cut it at this level. So, you know, obviously the crisis at 10 is a crisis, but maybe Frawley comes off the bench at 10 and does well. And like, you know, he's been good off the bench in massive games away from home before. So I would say Trimble at our roadshow was like, look, finish fourth, the new lads are just shit. Like, I mean, and he was laughing, but he was, there's an element of truth, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, these guys are so great, they can't cut it. Whereas if you play well in this team, you know.
Yeah, this is as strong as it can get kind of thing, yeah.
What do you make of the thing with Prendergast?
You wouldn't say it's been very well handled, would you?
I don't know. I genuinely, you know, because we kind of think of that and the way it's handled, and obviously there's a lot of pastoral care, I suppose, discussion of the pastoral element of it, of him being a young man and how he's treated and things like that. And then there's kind of the brute reality of it being professional sport and sort of a meritocracy. But I'm really interested in terms of like whatever way it's kind of both paths. Well, it could go, I suppose, one of three ways. That Crowley's grand and it's kind of fine for the next game. It's like, yeah, you're fine. There's nothing glaring. He's great. And it's like, okay, you get another extended run at this. Or he's, you know, performs poorly. And then it's, you know, come on down, Ciarán Frawley.
Well, or Harry like, Byrne. I think like, Frawley, this is Frawley's best case scenario at the moment, is 6-2 splits and he's the man on the bench.
It feels like a really important game in that regard. And maybe we're blowing that up because maybe it doesn't actually matter in the group. But I like, there's so few games of this magnitude against, like, say, tier one nations left before the World Cup. There's really not that many. Like, it's kind of, especially with the pressure and everything else, playing in such a kind of hostile environment. It's a fascinating discussion that, like, you've taken Prendergast out of that entirely. He'll play no part in this. Like, he'll never, so did he come on in 24? He's never started a game in Twickenham anyway, I presume, for Ireland. Like, he can't have, can he? Because
Won't have now before the
and
World
won't
Cup.
And yeah. won't like it's a, it, like that's small that might mean nothing but it's still an interesting thing that it just shows, I suppose, how fine the margins are with rugby when you're plotting these things out, that you don't have, like, I suppose we're so used to football's parameters where there's like a 50 odd game season and you'll get there's so many points you can hit and build up things of form, like these boys are like
thing.
It's so fine, the margins are so fine. So, like, what does it mean? What's his road back like?
Prendergast.
Yeah, say it's best case scenario for Crowley and Crowley lights it up and you're like, oh, this guy's, he's showing, he wants this, he's going to take this. What the hell does Prendergast have to do? So, does he start for Leinster when they come back in Champions Cup?
Well, it's a very long and interesting selection meeting, isn't it?
I mean,
now, I suspect you start Harry Byrne in that game and you put Prendergast on the bench. And then you give Prendergast the next URC game. And then you give Harry Byrne the game after that, which will, hopefully will be a quarter final for Leinster. And you take it from there. And you have a competition for them. And whoever wins, wins.
Yeah.
And that's the situation now. Whereas I was 100% in favour of giving Sam Prendergast the opportunity to play all of the games up until the start of the Six Nations. And last November, I was like, look, play him. Because Sexton was talking about, we didn't have enough depth at the position, and somebody else was talking about players didn't have enough exposure at the position. And if you look back at the out halves who replaced Sexton in big games, when Sexton was injured in World Cups, they had like one or two starts in massive games, and that's just not enough. Now, in a year's time, in 18 months' time, we'll be in the thick of the World Cup, and Prendergast, Crowley, Frawley, and Harry Byrne will all have had an opportunity. And at that point, you're just really hoping that one of them is in good form And that's the bit where...
You can just be that, can't it? Like, if they all have had the opportunity, all have got not the same level of experience, but a reasonable level of experience, the one who's playing the best at that given moment should just be able to step in and do it, like, yeah.
And you might also be in a situation where there is a horses for courses selection. Mm. Maybe the person who plays against France is different from the person who plays against South Africa, is different from the person who plays against England, is different from the person who plays against Scotland, depending on what the defensive likelihood or the game plan of the opposition is going to be. And we've reached a point there where actually we've depth at centre, we've depth on the wings, we've no depth at scrum half really at the moment, and we will have a range of out halves who can play, and we can go 6-2 split, we can go 5-3 split. Like, that's the upside to this. That's glass half full. Glass half empty is that Prendergast drifts off now and his confidence is shot to the point where he can't recover. Like, that, the range of outcomes here is huge.
And it's a really interesting dynamic, isn't it? Like, even in your glass half full scenario, and if you take, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong here, but if you take, as long as, say, for the last 20 odd years, or whatever time, maybe if you want to take from the real, when it starts really picking up and peaking from whatever, 09 onwards, whatever, it's always felt like there's been the dynamic between sort of who's the most important person in this setup. You'll have an off the field and an on the field. So you had like the Schmidt, I suppose, Sexton dynamic for that period onward, and similarly a Farrell Sexton dynamic where you kind of had that feeling that it was almost a 50-50 kind of feel to what was going on, that where the power, or where, the, not even power, because that suggests they're against one another, but where the dynamic of importance kind of rested with both of them. And it's interesting that increasingly now it seems, and the way the team's been written about, and your scenario there, where it's unlikely, maybe, that you have a definite top dog number 10 for the World Cup, that the power dynamic seems to have shifted entirely, that it's everyone knows that it's the coaching aspect of it that's been not questioned, but at least looked to for answers. I don't see any, you know, the kind of way it's like, this is the biggest challenge of Andy Farrell's career or whatever else. It's a very strange dynamic that it doesn't seem to be singling out players who are, we're going to be relying on. It's kind of, they all just seem part of a mass, that it doesn't, even the teams being like, I don't know now who the players are that you go, they're the big difference maker in terms of.
Can I, just on that, right? That's, I think you're correct, but I think it's a temporary thing, or at least I hope it's a temporary thing, because you would have said that, I think it was Tom English, was like, the spine of this team is really strong. You go Sheehan, Byrne, Conan, Sheehan, Byrne, Doris.
Yeah.
Like, none of them are actually playing to the level that they're capable of at the moment. And what is the cause of that? A Lions hangover, a lack of form, the game plan a bit murky. You know, Farrell was away for a year coaching a different team, thinking about something different, and now he's back and it hasn't quite bedded in. The misalignment between Leinster and the Ireland thing, the rest of the world catching up and doing a lot of work on us because we were the hunted for a period of time. That's a, you know, death by a thousand cuts.
Mm.
But I think that they can get back to a level where, like, Tyburn, everybody started the year like, oh, there's no Lions hangover there. And now Tyburn has a Lions hangover. Now he looks absolutely wrecked, right? Yeah. He wouldn't have been terribly surprised if he hadn't been picked. They rested him last week and, like, but Tyburn could get 4 turnovers this week against England. You know, under their posts, he could get 3 turnovers. We kick 2 of those to the corner, roll over, 2 tries. Dan Sheehan emerges from that, and you're like, whoa, these guys, look at them, they're back.
Yeah.
And here's the hinge point of the whole World Cup cycle, where we're doing to England what England did to us in 2022.
Mm.
Was that then?
Yeah.
So that's their hope. That's the. I think your question was like, what's our identity? Is it?
Well, I suppose it comes down a little bit to that. Who's the. Because now it just seems interesting, the narrative around it is so squarely rooted on Farrell. And it's an interesting kind of pressure, because I even feel as kind of monomaniacal a figure as Schmidt seemed in the driving force of that team, it was always kind of counterbalanced with the reliance, with the understanding that Sexton is the embodiment of that. It's kind of the Ferguson-Keane type situation where you have two kind of points of power in a team.
And the second period, when they won the second Champions League, what would you say that locus of power was then?
It was probably more spread out. It was probably an infusion of experience and, well, I suppose you recruited good recruitment and good development.
Yeah.
So maybe
Rio, Rooney.
And Ronaldo from a young age are coming in. But maybe it's a shifting thing. Maybe you just can't replace someone like Sexton. And ultimately, off the back of Sexton and O'Gara in most recent history, we have a warped view of what a 10 ought to be. And maybe Prendergast or Crowley or Frawley are never going to be good enough to match that, but maybe they become really effective members of a greater whole.
That's it. I think that's
a hard thing to... you can't ever say that. Do you know what I mean? Like, in terms of it's so bluntly. You can never say that, but maybe that is... That's a radical shift. I could see how that would take time.
I think they need to say all of that. I think they need to just be brutally honest with everybody who's watching, because I think that, like... The negativity and the toxicity online is somewhat fed by the defensiveness. I've been making this point all week, but I just think that, like, if they were to come out and say, our game plan is in evolution, we are struggling. This misalignment issue that you think is there with Leinster, it is there. It's a real thing. And we need to work with them over the next 6 months to get to the bottom of that. Or the players are having difficulty, you know, changing from one form to the other, but in the long run, that's going to benefit us because this, and this. Or actually, you know what? We're having conversations about that. We're having firm and frank discussion about what our policy is on this, and be like, or come out and rebut it. But like, professional rugby, it's not a big deal.
That does feed it. You're right, Sean.
Was it Goodman? Was it Goodman with the disingenuous about decline?
Yeah.
Which I get, because you can't admit that either. You can't say we're going backwards.
What did he say?
I don't want to misquote him, but it was earlier in the week. I think someone asked him about being in decline. Maybe he was out last week or was pre-match. Maybe it was
John Fogarty, I think, had the disingenuous line.
Oh, maybe it was. Sorry, maybe it wasn't Goodman. It might have been in mind. That's fine, yeah, probably.
Because I don't think Goodman's done media yet, which is another part of the, like, put your tack coach up and explain what you're trying to do here, because it's not great.
Yeah.
At the moment. We can't see the patterns. We can't see the phase play. Why are we no longer really good at passing and catching when we used to be very good at it?
Yeah.
And just address all this stuff, I think, would be my media strategy here, because the people love the rugby team. Like, I know loads of people hate the rugby team, but the rugby public who buy the jerseys and buy the phones and drink whatever the official drink is and get on Aer Lingus and see it and like, yeah, I understand this. They just want to hear the truth.
We can't get into this now because I can hear Jonathan Wilson's been set up. But do they love the team or do they love this success? And
I think that loads of people actually have come to love the team. I think that the scenes in Paris when Zombie was being sung and people going a bit mad, that was like an outpouring of people linking themselves to the team and feeling that they have a bit of... I think the people of Cove, again, not traditionally a rugby stronghold, were out for Edwin the Dogbo. And I think that, like, there's a lot to like about the team. Obviously, there are the class issues that people keep hanging on about, and it's a real thing. And but I think that if you were to come out and say, yeah, we're going through a bit of a struggle here, we need your help.
Yeah.
We need your help. Come and support us.
It would be a very interesting way of opening things up.
Some tickets were on sale for Ireland Wales. From one of the now they were gone like that.
Yeah,
but I've never seen it. I got an email with the travel company saying, we've got some tickets back. Like, what? How did that happen? Anyway, we got to go. Jonathan Wilson, standing by. Cash machine.